Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Our study of 2 Kings today, and we're going to be dealing with Jehu. What an interesting man he is. A combination of faithfulness and treachery. All in the same person. His acts are much like Zimri's against Baashan that we studied earlier in the King series. It's one of those tensions that we don't know how to really deal with. He is acting in fulfillment of prophecy. The prophecy of Elijah in 1 Kings 19. The prophecy of Elisha in 2 Kings 9. He's fulfilling the word of God. And yet, in Hosea, he is condemned. Hosea 1:4, he is condemned for his acts. So apparently it's not the acts that he committed. They're going to be bloody acts. But it's not the acts themselves, but the motive behind the acts. And so here we have a man who really seemed to be zealous for the Lord, but did not go completely to eradicate all the problems in the northern kingdom. Notice, if you would, it says Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. Now, of course, Samaria is the capital that Ahab's father Omri built. It was an extremely fortified position. Three sides of this mountaintop fortress were 400-foot drops to the valley. Only one side had to be fortified. It was so strong that when the Assyrians finally attacked Samaria, it took 3 full years for that powerful army to finally break in. Now, his 70 sons were there. He is dead. Jezebel's dead. Now, it's not his son. 70 is a round number. We're talking about male descendants. Some would be his sons, some would be grandsons, some would be nephews. It's that kind of thing. Now, they were under guardians. And guardians, we mean the officials that were in charge of their education, that were in charge of their health, that were in charge of their getting a financial stipend. These are the men we're talking about. And Jehu wrote letters and sent them to Samaria to the rulers of Jezreel. Now, to the rulers of Jezreel really is a problem in the Hebrew. If you read this, obviously, Jehu is in Jezreel, and he's writing to the guardians of the children in Samaria. There's been much speculation about the problem in the Hebrew text here. Some think the original was to the rulers of Israel that got corrupted in scribal transmission. Now, the Septuagint does have the leaders in Samaria, the rulers in Samaria. But the word in Hebrew for Jezreel and the word for Samaria are not close at all. But the word for Jezreel and the word for Israel are close, and it seems that that's where the scribal error occurred. Now, Jehu is said to be of the tribe of Manasseh by the rabbis in fulfillment of Genesis 48:19. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. It's just speculation. Okay? So he writes this letter, and he says, "Amen. You pick out the strongest male descendant of Ahab, and you put him on the throne, and you get his army ready, because I'm coming." Well, these guardians were not military men. They said, "My goodness, you've defeated 2 kings in one day." Now, what is he referring to? Well, if you look down at verse 4, that's where these people rationalize their compromise by killing all these children, by saying, "We can't stand against Jehu. He killed 2 kings. Now, the 2 kings mentioned are found in the chapter 9. One is the king of Judah, who was a grandson of Jezebel's, probably why he died also. And then Joram of Israel, Ahab's child, on the throne. Okay? When this happened. So he writes them a letter, and they write back and say, "Oh, we can't stand against you. Whatever you want, we'll do." So Jehu writes a second letter back and says, "I want you to cut off the heads of every one of these male descendants, and I want you to bring them to me in Jezreel by tomorrow." Now, here's a map, and you can see that Jezreel is not very far from Samaria. He didn't want these leaders to have too much time to think about what he asked them to do. He also really wanted these leaders to take the heat from the populace in killing these 70 children. Now, how old they were, we don't know, probably from young men down, but this was a gruesome act, 70 young boys beheaded. Now, beheaded is not extremely unusual. From the Assyrian records, we find many people beheaded in these obelisks and pictures. So it wasn't a terribly uncommon thing. Now, notice in verse 8 where he mentions, "at the entrance of the gate until morning." Now, probably the purpose for this was to be so conspicuous that everybody would see it. And often to know that he did not do it. Now, some say it's the gate is the place of judgment, and this was a symbol of God's judgment on Ahab's family. Now, that may be, but knowing Jehu, I think he was doing it for the conspicuous nature of this act by these guardians and not by himself. For you see, the populace did not know that he's the one that conspired this. Now, in verse 9, he gets up in front of the people and says, I want you to know that you are innocent. Behold, I conspired against my master and killed him. But who killed all these? Now, the little sneak is really setting the stage. First of all, he's saying, men of Jezreel, you're not guilty of this blood. You see, that goes back to Deuteronomy 21, 1 through 9, where the city was guilty if a body was found close to its gate. There was some kind of ceremonial defilement related to dead bodies. What he's saying is, now, I did kill the king. But he's saying, who killed all these young boys? Like, as if he didn't know. Now, I think if you look at verse 11 and verse 17, I think Ahab is going to have these guardians killed. Now, whether verse 11 is talking about that or verse 17 is talking about that, I think they're all going to be killed to cover up the treachery of this man. Now, notice in verse 10, know then that there shall fall to the earth nothing of the word of the Lord. Now, this is a metaphor very similar to 1 Samuel 3:19, this falling to the earth. Now, in our culture, something of this idiom is that we never let our flag touch the ground, a symbol of it would be dishonored or degraded by a flag touching the ground. That's something of a similar metaphor to one aspect of God's prophecy will not be unfulfilled. That's the idea. Notice it says, which the Lord spoke concerning the house of Ahab. Now, you might want to go back to Elijah's prophecy, found in 1 Kings 21, verses 19, 21, and 29, and Elisha's prophecy, found in 2 Kings 9, 8. And there's where both, this is predicted twice, the terrible destruction of Ahab's house. Okay, the king is leaving Jezreel. He's going to Samaria, all right, the capital city. On the way, he stops by a shearing place. Notice in verse 12 it says, Beth Eked. Now, Beth is the Hebrew word for house. So this means the house of binding, literally. But what it is, when you shear sheep, apparently, and I'm not a sheep shearer, so I don't really know, but somehow you tie either their front legs or back legs together while you're shearing them to keep them from jumping and getting away and hurting themselves. And so apparently it was a place where shepherds meet. So it must have been a covering, some kind of lean-to, with some water available. Now, while he was on the way, he met the relative of Ahaziah, which is the king of Judah. There was apparently 42 of them. Now, because it's so specific, 40 would be a round number, but 42 seems to say they had their whole entourage with them, a large group of relatives from the king of Judah. Now, the king of Judah has already been killed, but they don't know it. Now, these are relatives of who? Jezebel and Ahab. So they're doomed, too, with this prophecy of all of his house will be cut off. So, and he said, who are you? And they answered quite forthrightly, we are the relatives of the king of Judah, which have come down to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother, Jezebel. And he said, take them alive. Now, there's been some real confusion in the text here. He says, take them alive, and then he immediately is going to kill them. Now, there's been speculation. Did they put up a fight? Did he take them alive and then take them to a certain ritual place and ritually kill them? We're really not sure. But though he says, take them alive, what happens? They're going to be killed very quickly. Now, it's somewhat unusual about this king of Judah having any relatives of all. Because if you'll look at 2 Chronicles 21, verse 17, and 2 Chronicles 22, 1, you'll see that most of this man's family had been killed by Arabs in a raid before his ascension to the throne. So probably when it says his relatives, we're not talking about his definite children, but from 2 Chronicles 22, 8, there was a large number of his brother's sons or nephews, and that probably is who this is. Now, notice if you will, when he had departed from there, he met Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. Now, I have a graphic I'd like to show you that deals. Notice the Rechabites, they were a very important tribe at this period of Israel's history for the simple fact they were extreme Yahwehists. Basically, they're an Arab tribe of Kenites or Midianites. So that means they're related to Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, as you can see from Genesis 18. We learn about their presence in the north from Judges 4, 17 through 22. But I guess the major passage is Jeremiah 35, 1 through 19, which really describes the nomadic and rather aesthetic existence of this particular tribe. Now, let's look then where he wants this man to help him. And so in verse 15 he says, "And he greeted him and said to him, is your heart right as my heart is with your heart?" What he's really saying, whose side are you on, fella? He really wanted to know. Now, notice it says, "And Jehu said, if it is, give me your hand." Our custom of handshaking to kind of settle agreement or say hello, that is basically Greco-Roman and not Jewish. Although, we have one example of that in Ezra 10:19. But this doesn't seem to be an agreement they're doing. It seems he's helping him up in the chariot. Now, chariots at this period in Palestine could hold three or four people. There was usually a chariot driver, the significant person, and an armor bearer. So apparently, he was trying to help this man up. It's going to be good for him. It's kind of like during political contest, the candidate wants to be seen with important people of the local area. Well, that's exactly what Jehu wants. He wants to be seen with this Rechabite. And so he asked him to get up in his chariot. Verse 16, he said, "Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord." Now, that implies two things. Jehu is acting in what he believes a prophetic fulfillment. It also says something about this man, his faith in Yahweh. Okay, so here are two committed Yahwehists acting. Now, in verse 17, it mentions the idea of the words of Elijah, and that's 2 Kings 9:8. We've talked about it earlier. Now, in verse 18 is another trick to eliminate Baal worship in Israel. Notice what's happening. So Jehu gathered all the people and said to them, "Ahab served Baal a little. Jehu will serve him much." Now, I bet the people didn't realize, but Jehu's name is a form of the Hebrew name for God. Yahweh, Exodus 3:14, means "I am that I am." Jehu means "he is." But people didn't think about what was happening. He killed the Joram, the king, by saying, "Your mother is a sorceress and wicked." They didn't really catch that he was against Baalism. So he is really lying and saying, "Boy, I'm really for Baal, and we're going to have a tremendous feast. We're going to have a solemn assembly, and I want everybody in the country who loves Baal to come to Baal's temple in Samaria." So he's going to set the stage for a gigantic slaughter. Look at verse 19. "And now summon all the prophets of Baal and all his worshiper and all his priests. Let no one be missing, for I have a great sacrifice to Baal. And whoever is missing shall not live." Now, this probably means the local big dogs, if you please, of Baalism, not just every Tom, Dick, and Harry. I don't think that all fit in that one temple. But the priests, the prophets, the big supporters in the surrounding areas and all the way from Dan to Bethel. Now, notice the distinction, which it seems unusual for us, between prophets and priests. Now, in the Old Testament, there's a major distinction. But it's unusual, I think, that there's a distinction in Baalism between prophets and priests. Now, this really shouldn't surprise us because we learn from archaeological evidence that there was a distinction in Egypt between prophets and priests and in Phoenicia, which is the home of Baalism. Apparently, the prophets were more significant. Now, the reason I say that, in 1 Kings 19, where it mentions the prophets of Baal and Asherah, 900 of them, it doesn't mention the priest at all. And so that's why we think the prophets were more significant. 1 Kings 18:19 and 22:6 are where they're mentioned. Now, notice in verse 21, it mentions the house of Baal was filled from one end to the other. Now, apparently there's two doors, this huge temple-like place. Most of these temples had a little bitty shrine and a large court area for the worshipers to come with some kind of altar there. This means from mouth to mouth it was full. So from door to door it was full, packed. Notice the mention in verse 22 of these wardrobe and garments. Apparently, there were special robes that the priest wore. Now, whether all the worshipers of Baal put on these special robes, we're not sure. There's some argument about was it a fancy party dress or was it a white linen smock kind of thing. The white linen smock seems to be true. And whether it's all the priests or just some people is not certain. But personally, when you think of this place being packed from door to door, it'd be real difficult to distribute robes for all the different people, for all the different sizes. I think it's talking about the priest and the prophets putting on these robes, really. Now, verse 25. "And it came about, as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the royal officers, 'Go in and kill them, let none come out.' And they killed them with the edge of the sword, and the guard and the royal officers threw them out, and they went in the inner room, the house of Baal. There's a little disruption in the Hebrew here. I'm not really certain that when they kill these people, they threw their bodies out. It seems to be, maybe the implication is, when they cut them with their sword, they knocked them out of their way. Now, there is a large group of people dead here. The blood must have been unbelievable. And every one of these were killed because Jehu said, if you let one of them get away, I'll require your life at their, you know, for theirs. So he kills all of them. And notice in verse 26, and he brought out the sacred pillars. Now we learn from archaeological evidence that the Phoenician pantheon was represented by uncut, uncarved, canonical cylinders. And so it's going to talk about burning them. It's real hard to burn stone. I think it refers to the Asherah that was next to Baal in these temples. Now, the Asherah, we know, was possibly a live tree, but more commonly a carved tree. Maybe a carving that represented the tree of life in the Garden of Eden. Maybe the sacredness of trees. Maybe the mother goddess was carved into a tree. But probably they burnt the Asherah and smashed the altar and the pillars of Baal. Verse 27, they broke down the sacred pillar. That fits better, something you do with stone. And broke down the house of Baal and made it a latrine to this day. Old Jehu, boy, he wanted this whole site to be condemned. Now we learn from Deuteronomy 23:12-24 that any kind of bodily excretions for the Jews made them ceremonially unclean. Whether nocturnal admissions for males or monthly menstrual period for women or afterbirth at child or leprosy or any kind of bodily admissions. So can you imagine what turned this whole temple area into one gigantic latrine? What kind of sarcasm and reproach that was, as well as defiling the whole area. Now, in verse 29 is an interesting account because Jehu seems to do such a good job of cleansing the whole nation of Baal worship. But in verse 29 it says he is condemned for not going one step further. You see, even though the prophets condemned it, I do not think this king understood that the golden calf worship that Jeroboam the first set up in 922 to keep his people away from Jerusalem when the kingdom split was an abhorrence to God. Now, this is not idolatry, because that young calf was a symbol of Yahweh. That's why Aaron's calf that he made in the Exodus was not idolatry, but a symbol of Yahweh. But there became a confusion. Baal was also symbolized by a bull. And so the Ten Commandments say, thou shalt make no representation, physical representation, of anything in heaven. And that was one of the problems of the golden calf. The other one was that it took worshipers away from the centralized shrine chosen by God, which is Jerusalem. And so this king, along with all other northern kings, is condemned because he did not stop this golden calf worship. Now, in verse 30 is an interesting account about that God is pleased enough that he's going to say, Jehu, you've done what I've said. And because you've done what I've said, I'm going to give you the throne of Israel for the four generations. Now, I've got a graphic I want to show you on the descendants of Jehu. You see him there. Jehoaz, there's the date. Joash, Jeroboam II is the only king that reigned longer than Jehu. And Zechariah, which reigned only for 6 months, okay? Now, notice if you would where it mentions Hazael in verse 32. Now we're going to come to the problems that Jehu had. God said, yes, I'll give you a stable reign and I'll leave the throne to your children for four generations. But Jehu also, because we learn from Hosea 1:4, did not have a good heart toward God. And therefore, God's going to take away part of the kingdom. Now, Hazael is the Syrian leader. And he is really somebody. He is a military machine. We learn from Assyrian documents that Assyria had major problems with him. They finally defeated him, but they never took his territory. They just kind of left him alone. He was really a problem. We even learn from later on, let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, chapter 12, verses 17 and 18. If you'll look at a map, he took the Mediterranean coast, even down into Philistia, which is to the west of Judah. He captured all of that. The whole Transjordan area is going to be taken away from the kingdom of Israel. They lost all of Transjordan, all of the Mediterranean coast, most of Philistia, to this Syrian commander. And boy, he was really something, I want to tell you. Now, let's see. In verse 34, "And now the rest of the acts of Jehu and all that he did and all his might are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel?" Now, we learn from the black obelisk of Salmaneser III, we learn about Hazael's military power, but we also see a picture of King Jehu bowing before the Assyrian king, paying tribute. This is the only northern king that says all his might. Isn't it ironical that the one king who lost so much of his territory to Hazael and had to pay tribute to the Assyrian monarch is called a mighty man of valor? Well, apparently it describes his attitude and not his military conquest, because he just didn't have many military conquests. And that black obelisk really helps us coordinate some of the history of what's happening during this time. Notice, if you would, in verse 36 where it says, "Now the time which Jehu reigned over Israel in Samaria was 28 years. Now, compared to the other kings, that is extremely stable. They've been knocking each other off every few years now. It is a mess compared to the stability of the Judean throne. So to have a reign of 28 years, and one of his children, Jeroboam II, is going to have a reign of 41 years, shows a very stable dynasty that Jehu began." This is a very good account, I think, of the fact that you can fulfill the will of God and do it with the wrong motive. Jehu is a very hard person to understand. He has a commitment to God, a zeal, but his heart's not quite right. His motives aren't quite right. And I think that's a pretty good lesson for all of us. I wonder if what we do for God, if we ever have analyzed our motives. Do we do it out of gratitude for the love that God has for us? Are we always looking for what it'll do for us? What's best for number one? Well, it's hard to know about Jehu. And ladies and gentlemen, I must admit to you, it's hard to know about me sometimes. Why I do religious things. I want it to be out of devotion. I want it to be out of following God's will. I want it to be out of gratitude. But my motives are always mixed. And it's so hard to know exactly why we do what we do for God. So important we look at it. Jehu fulfills God's will, but is condemned by Hosea. Think about it. I've really enjoyed being with you. And I hope you'll pray for me. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.